Well, I want to come back and talk to you about what it was like to live in a city and what kind of things we might see in the city. First of all, remember that old immigrants is a term that we want to be familiar with. Old immigration came from Western Europe, Ireland, England, Germany. Okay, these folks knew the language. They had a skill. They were mainly Protestant peoples and just very industrious. But by the 1890s, remember the decade of populism, the decade of the Statue of Liberty, the decade of the Chicago World's Fair, the decade of Plessy versus Ferguson, the decade of the Wilmington Race Riot, you begin to have new immigration into America. New immigrants were from Southern and Eastern Europe. They did not have a skill. They did not know the language. They tended to be predominantly Catholic. Okay? And so new immigrants could come from Eastern Europe, or they could come from the Asian world, from Japan and from China. Okay? And between 1880 and 1920, there'll be four major waves of immigration into the country. If you were coming from Europe, you debarked at Ellis Island. Oftentimes your name was changed. You're deloused. You're given a book about how to become a good American. If you're coming from Asia, you come in at Angel Island in San Francisco. Okay? You would live in ethnic communities. And, you know, one of the theories in the late 1800s, early 1900s about being an immigrant is that America is a melting pot. America is a place to blend in. Remember the Statue of Liberty, good example. Remember the Statue of Liberty and the Pledge of Allegiance? These are things that would have been used to assimilate immigrants into American culture. So, you know, the best example of the melting pot I can give you is tomato soup. If you look at tomato soup, there's the same texture. There's not a lot of differences. And so tomato soup might be a good metaphor or visual picture to get you thinking about the goal of the melting pot. Today we don't do this as much. We think about the metaphor of the salad bowl. If you look at a really good salad, you have different textures, different colors, and those are recognized as part of the whole, to be important, to be a part of the whole. So remember the melting pot idea, and remember the cultural pluralist idea, which is basically the salad bowl idea, that people are welcome. Okay? Of course, we know that immigration is always an issue in our elections, all right? And, you know, we recognize that people have different feelings about it. If you were a nativist, and I really want you to pay attention to what a nativist was. A nativist is somebody who just has a great fear or a great unease or a great dislike of foreigners. Nativists before the Civil War organized the Know-Nothing Party. You might want to remember that from AM1 about trying to restrict immigration. Remember the populists in the 1890s, that was one of their goals, to restrict immigration. In 1882, you had the first immigration restriction, and that was called the Chinese Exclusion Act. And it first banned Chinese immigrants into the country for about 10 years, and then it kept adding up, kept being redone every 10 years. It doesn't really go away until World War II. Urban growth. By 1900, half the people were living in cities, half the people were living on farms. We're going to find by 1920, more people are living in cities than on farms. Remember Frederick Jackson Turner had used the 1890 census. He'd used that data to basically say that the West was closed, that a new frontier needed to be embarked upon by the United States. The country's growing up. Louis Sullivan had helped to design skyscrapers. Okay, the Flatiron Building is a good example of a skyscraper. You now had the Otis Elevator. Otis Elevator Company being one of the most famous American companies. And so with the elevator, you can go up more. And so now you'll have buildings of 8, 9, 10, 12 plus floors. And remember that this is a part of industrialization. And in living in some of these skyscrapers or tenement houses are immigrants living in ethnic neighborhoods. A tenement was a whole series of networks where immigrants lived. And they might live 20 to a room. Okay? If you remember a gentleman we talked about, Jacob Riis, who did the first photojournalist studies of slums and immigrant living, remember the name of his book, How the Other Half Lives. And he's going to expose in a lot of ways how immigrants are living, how they're being dominated by the political machine. You had all kinds of urban problems as people migrate to the city. You didn't have adequate sewer systems. You didn't have adequate water systems. Not every bigger city had a fire department. So these were issues. A good example is the San Francisco fire and then the earthquake, 1906, 1908. And one of the big issues out west, particularly in San Francisco, is going to be the lack of water. And that's going to be something that's going to be picked up in one of our later units. Two people that you really want to know about in the city, and they'll both end up being progressives, considered progressive people. And that's Jacob Riis. We mentioned him, How the Other Half Lives, and then Jane Addams. Jane Addams will start settlement houses to help immigrants assimilate, if you will, to get a leg up in Chicago. You could go on a Sunday afternoon. You could take an English lesson. You could have daycare. And a settlement house was a place for you to stay so that you could be made better. And Jane Addams was the first American woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, that's pretty cool for her settlement house movement. And she uses the models of the houses in England to create Hull House in Chicago, which has been completely restored today. Her favorite writer was Leo Tolstoy. And so she uses her concept of the poor and the immigrant to try her best to make life better. So remember, immigrants, okay, new immigrants, all right, from Eastern Europe, from Asia, oftentimes living in an ethnic neighborhood, in a tenement house, okay, being able to have services through the settlement houses. And slum living and immigrant living was exposed by Jacob Riis, okay. Some of the things that the political machines were doing was exposed by the greatest artist of this time, and that is a guy by the name of Thomas Nast, and we already looked at his Reconstruction cartoon. There are three things that you need to know about work and strikes during this time. Labor unions were not recognized and will not be recognized until 1938 under the Wagner Act during the New Deal. But why did labor unions organize? Basically one thing. They're trying to improve the conditions of workers in a factory. Remember why the populist organized. There was no workplace safety. There was no standard eight-hour workday. I mean, these were real important to kind of think about. Urban labor increased 400% by 1890. Most of the workers were unskilled. They're coming off the farm. They're returning from work at a homestead, because that didn't work out. And they come into a mill or a mine, particularly in the South, and there's not a lot of protection. Some of these folks are immigrants, so they can't even speak English. But, you know, working conditions at this time, low wages, long hours. There was an accident in the mill or the mine at least every other day on average. There was also a rampant amount of child labor. If you were the Greek and Italian immigrants that are working in the Colorado fields, the coal and iron mines in Colorado, you don't even have a floor in your shack that you're living in. So company towns could really put a hurt on you because you're living in a company home. You're paying rent in a company home. And you're working, across the street, if you will, from the factory or just down the road from the factory. So these were things to kind of think about. You didn't want to cause trouble because if you caused trouble, you could be blacklisted. You could be locked out from the factory. There could be an injunction, a legal stoppage of your work, or you could be fired, and then a scab worker could be hired to replace you. And that wasn't always very fun to watch your job be taken by somebody else. Labor unions wanted to go on strike to bring up some of these issues. They wanted to be able to have the right to sit down and collective bargain with the employers. They wanted to have their things solved through arbitration by a third party. Again, these things are going to come later. There had been a great strike in 1877, the railroad strike, and Eugene Debs, a socialist, becomes very actively involved in helping workers go on strike to improve their living conditions. The first big incident occurred at the Haymarket Riot just about 9 years after this in Chicago. The Knights of Labor had been organized by a gentleman by the name of Terence Powderly. And again, this was a unit of skilled and unskilled laborers. There is an incident in Chicago, and several of the strikers are arrested near the McCormick Reaper plant. They'll be hanged. And basically, you want to remember, for our purposes, that the Haymarket Riot the Haymarket Riot is going to be the end of the Knights of Labor as a viable labor union. One of the reasons is because they had skilled and unskilled laborers, and those unskilled laborers could not always organize really well, but also just did not have enough leverage with different people to make a difference. Plus, the bosses, if you were, again, if you were a striking worker, would label you a communist, a socialist, a bad dude. And the Haymarket Riot occurred during the McCormick Reaper strike in Chicago in 1886. There was a bomb thrown at a protest. Several people are killed. Union activity is blamed. And again, those union leaders were arrested and tried and hanged. Samuel Gompers comes along after this. He is the champion of the American working man. Actually writes a pamphlet about what the working man wants. Okay? He kind of solved the problem with the Knights of Labor by only allowing skilled workers to join a labor union, okay? You know, women workers were very influential during this time. They worked for better condition for minors, okay? Women and children were used in the strike process, all right? A lady that was a tireless supporter of striking workers was a woman, happens to be on your vocabulary list. Her name was Mother Jones. Mother Jones was a tireless champion of the striking worker, whether it was Colorado oil and gas fields, iron fields, Massachusetts with child labor, West Virginia in the coal mines. She traveled around. She organized rallies. She made sure that striking workers had a tent to live in if they were evicted from their company home. She was just an amazing, amazing lady. You have the Homestead Strike. In 1892, you have the Pullman strike in 1894. The Pullman strike was the first time that government actually broke up a strike because President Cleveland sent in federal troops to break up a strike. You have the Homestead strike in 1892 that caused the first lockout in American history. Henry Clay Frick, the manager of the Carnegie Steel Plant in Homestead, Pennsylvania, will lock the workers out. And whether it was the Virginia coal fields or the coal fields of Colorado or the mill towns, you know, a lot of times these companies had their own police to kind of enforce workers, to kind of keep workers in line. Two of the most popular were the Baldwin Felts Agency and also the Pinkerton Detectives. The Pinkerton Detectives were sent to put down the Homestead Strike. The Baldwin Felts Agency attempted many times to clear up the struggle in the coal fields in West Virginia by assassinating striking miners, influential strikers, or influential people in the community like Chief Hatfield, Sid Hatfield, of Hatfield and McCoy fame. In 1914, you had the Ludlow Strike. And the Ludlow Strike was a strike of Greek and Italian workers in Colorado. Again, they wanted better conditions. They lost their company homes, and they migrated to a tent city. And, this was a Rockefeller-owned company. And so John Rockefeller Jr. hired out the Colorado National Guard to suppress the striking workers in the tents. The striking workers knew that gunmen were coming, so they dug pits in the bottom of their tents. So if bullets flew through the tents, women and children could get down into the pit. In 1914, while the world begins to go to war, in the Great War, America not in it just yet, but there'll be something called the Ludlow Massacre, where women and children are burned to death as bullets go into tents, as fires are started by the guardsmen to try to affect the striking workers, and many children and women will be killed. They'll die of smoke inhalation and other wounds, and you can go to Ludlow, Colorado today and see a monument to the people who passed away there. So what do we know during the Gilded Age, just kind of in review? The Gilded Age was a great time of invention and technology, and there were certainly some good things that were happening. You know, Mark Twain publishes his masterpiece, Huckleberry Finn, in 1883. Almost done on time. Mark Twain publishes his masterpiece in 1883. The Statue of Liberty goes up in 1886. The Chicago World's Fair occurs in 1893. Things like the steam engine are put on display at the Philadelphia Exposition in 1876. Again, we talked about movies and music. This is a time of vaudeville where you could go to the movie and see some acts, like a juggling act or people sitting on all manner of chairs. It's a great time of entertainment as the silent film comes of age. Baseball and boxing are two of the most famous sports during this time because they could be reported fairly quickly through the use of the telegraph. You have Thomas Edison's phonograph, first put on display in 1889 at the Paris World's Fair, that will record your voice and play it back for you. So these are just wonderful things. You have the bicycle craze of the late 1800s that women will certainly be involved in. You have the bloomer pant that will be developed so that women can, you know, ride bicycles and not be vulgar by throwing up their dress because they've still got the bloomer pants on underneath. So a lot of wonderful things happen in the Gilded Age. We'll see a guy like Teddy Roosevelt come of age. In the 1880s, his wife, his first wife and his mom died on the same day in the same house. So, you know, he will kind of retreat to the Badlands for a little bit during the Gilded Age, but then he's going to come back big and fierce as first a vice presidential candidate and then a president. So we're going to see Teddy Roosevelt come of age. We're going to see America begin to become a world power. And so these are things we have to look forward to. Have a great day, and be sure to study of your notes and look at that PowerPoint for the Gilded Age.